Okay, welcome everyone. Episode 37 of the Academy of Management's Review Origin series, our podcast and YouTube series, in which we take you behind the curtain and help unpack, understand, and explore the nuances of how Academy of Management review papers, accepted manuscripts are developed, how they evolve, and what goes on behind the scenes as the authors go to work on these kinds of papers. So today, I'm thrilled to be joined by the full author team of the paper entitled When Subjective Judgments Lead to Spinouts, Employee Entrepreneurship Under Uncertainty, Firm Specificity, and Appropriability. So the authors here are Asim Kyol, Martin Ganko, and Joe Raffi, and they're going to be talking us through what went into this paper. It's a formal modeling paper, but explores a sort of very interesting scenario in which employees have the opportunity to do something internally or externally and are making decisions about where they may go with an initial idea. But before we get into the paper, let's just get introduced to who we're talking to. So, Asim, if we can start with you, if you can just briefly introduce yourself, where are you at? What sort of research do you do? And then we'll go to Martin and then to Joe.
Sure. Thanks, Greg. My name is Asim Kaul. I'm at the University of Minnesota. And I would say my research interests are primarily in thinking about comparative governance. So how are different types of economic activity organized either within firms or through markets? Martin?
Yeah, thank you. So first of all, thanks for organizing this and thanks for having us. I think this is a great opportunity to talk about the paper. So I am I'm Martin Ganko. I'm at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I'm in the Department of Department of Management and Human Resources, and my work, most of it is strategic human capital. I also study entrepreneurship and mostly this relationship between existing firms and startups.
Cool. Joe?
Hey, Greg. Great to be here. So I'm Joe Raffi. I'm at the University of Southern California. Research interests are largely around labor markets, strategic human capital, and entrepreneurship. So fun to be here.
Awesome. So before we jump into the paper, what's the connection between the three of you? Where's the connecting point? How do the three of you sort of overlap with one another? Before we jump into actually, how do you go about writing this paper?
I think Martin's the broker here between the structural hole, right? Because Martin used to be at Minnesota, and when this paper started, you know, we were colleagues, and then I think he moved very shortly after to Wisconsin, where Joe was a PhD student at the time, which also tells you how long it's been. Like, Joe's beard was a lot shorter then. You know, so he moved to Wisconsin, met Joe, and, you know, that's how we all kind of got started working together.
That makes a whole lot of sense now. And as you point out, it does illustrate that, you know, AMR papers are not born in a weekend, or some people sometimes think, oh, you just write it over a few days or a few weeks, it's submitted and it gets published. So if we get into this, I had a shot at trying to explain very, very high level what this paper is about, but probably butchered it a bit. But Asim, if you want to just help us understand what is the essence of the paper, the elevator pitch, the slightly more extended elevator pitch of what you're doing here and what you're ultimately explaining.
So and Martin and Joe, you know, feel free to jump in. I think what we're trying to do in the paper is provide a mapping between the different ways in which a new idea can be commercialized, right? Three different ways. You can either commercialize it within the existing firm where the idea comes up. You can sort of sell it on the market, or you can form your own firm and you know, do a, say, entrepreneurial spin out. And mapping those three outcomes to the implications of that for value creation and value capture, to the nature of the idea itself, specifically, as the title suggests, to the extent of uncertainty, to the extent that it relies on firm-specific knowledge and to the appropriability of the firm. And one of the main, I think, key interesting insights that comes out of doing that exercise, beyond sort of integrating what we already know, is we come up with this case of what we call voluntary spinouts, which are basically situations where, contrary to sort of conventional wisdom, where, you know, spinouts happen where the employer says, I'm not interested, and the employee kind of has to go start their own firm. These are situations where the employer is very interested in the idea, actually wants to commercialize it in-house, but nevertheless, the employee prefers to go out and start their own firm because their beliefs about, you know, what the value of the idea is much higher than the value that the firm sees. And so that's kind of an interesting, I think, twist on, you know, the normal spin-out idea that comes out of the model and comes out of the theory. Martin and Joe, if you want to add something.
So maybe I just add very quickly. So the prior literature thinks about some of the mechanisms already, and there is prior theoretical work that talks about these mechanisms. But what we do in this paper, we bring some of these things together, as Asim was saying, under the umbrella of what is the nature of the ideas and what are some of these characteristics of the idea, such as uncertainty and firm specificity and appropriability. And then we show, once you bring these mechanisms together, there's actually novel cases that have not been discussed in prior work, and it kind of highlights some complexity of the interactions between some of these mechanisms, and then hopefully creates things which are maybe will have some future, you know, can be examined empirically, and we can think about what is the relative importance of these different outcomes as potential subsequent work. So kind of building more holistic and more comprehensive theory by bringing different mechanisms together reveals things which have not been highlighted before.
Yeah, that was certainly my sentiment in reading the paper, was this is not a question that hasn't been addressed before, but it's typically been addressed in a fairly sort of simplistic kind of, or one-to-one kind of matching relationships, and never bringing together a multitude of sort of contingencies and factors. And so prior literature might have pointed to one of these factors and said, oh, this happens then. And another paper looks at another one of these factors. And so it's in the bringing together of specificity, appropriability, uncertainty, that we start to, and the modeling of that, that we get this unique perspective and this more granular and probably more realistic insight into when are employees going to keep their ideas inside an existing organization and develop them internally versus sell them to a rival versus go out and create a spin out. And so it just felt like, oh, this is a big jump forward because we've got so many more pieces of the puzzle in one model. So how did you, what was the genesis of all of this? Where did it start? And then how did it evolve from there?
So, and, you know, obviously different people will have different memories. And you know, as you said, it's taken a long time to get this published. So, you know, but my memory of this is, you know, so Martin, as I said, Martin was at Minnesota, and, you know, he was doing some work. He's done a lot of work thinking about spinouts. And, but specifically, he was at we were both at a conference, and I was watching him present this paper that he published later with Florence and Alfonso, talking about spinouts and this idea that, you know, as I said, we often think spinouts happen because the firm doesn't value the idea. But what they were showing and finding in that paper was, often these are ideas that the firm thinks of very highly, yet spinouts still happen. And so he was kind of talking about that. And, you know, separately, I've been doing some work thinking about, you know, building off my 2013 org science paper, thinking about, you know, under what circumstances might someone want to rely on an existing firm versus starting their own firm to commercialize their ideas. And one of my sort of dissatisfactions with the existing literature was, well, okay, so your current employer turns you down, why would the next thing you do be go start a firm of your own, right? Why not go to somebody else and say, look, those jerks don't understand how brilliant I am, why don't you give me a job, right? Yeah. So why does that not happen? And so, you know, I was kind of thinking about that. Martin was talking about this kind of notion that, you know, people will leave even when the firm values them. So I think we basically started talking about it, and we came to the conclusion that, you know, there's something missing here. And as Greg, you were suggesting, right, we really need this kind of more holistic model of what are all the different things that might happen and what might determine those. And then I think, you know, so we were still talking about this when Martin moved, and then, you know, I think he met Joe. Joe was doing really exciting. And I think we had this intuition that it's going to be about firm specificity. There's something about the firm specific nature of the knowledge that the entrepreneur is building on that's going to preclude them from using other employers, and also make it potentially likely that even the firm themselves may not appreciate what they're doing. And so as we started to think about that, and, you know, Joe was doing some really exciting stuff thinking about firm specific human capital and these kind of alternate ways of engaging in entrepreneurship. So we brought him on board and said, hey, we really need your help to figure this out. And that's kind of, I think, where we got started. And then, of course, you know, once we started to build the model, it kind of got more and more complicated. But I think that was the sort of initial spark, as I remember it.
Awesome. So Joe, you join on board. Have you got a background in formal modeling? Is that something you've been trained in? I just didn't associate it as much, I guess, with your identity as with others. And so what's been your experience of jumping on board and then building out this pretty extensive formal model?
Yeah, so that's an interesting and good question. So if I recall correctly, and again, it's been now at this point, we're in 2023, so it must have been 9 years ago, 8 years ago, right? But I recall, you know, I was talking with Martin about projects, and we started talking about this general idea, and there were a lot of overlaps with things that I was doing. And I believe at the time there was a sketch of a model, very, very early stage. And so I took it, and kind of Martin said, can you run with this? What do you think? And we actually weren't sure if it was going to be a model or pure verbal theory. So at one point, I drafted out a fairly long verbal theory paper. We circulated it, and then we started thinking, look, there's lots of interconnections here. It probably makes more sense to do this more of a model like it was originally intended. So there was kind of, to your point, right, I'm not extensively trained in formal modeling. So it's been fun, and it's been a learning process. But definitely I have to tip my hat to Asim as the magic modeler who's done the heavy lifting on this. But it's you know, it is interesting. The more you start to work on these projects, the more you start to be able to think in terms of simple toy models. And it actually has helped quite a bit when you're thinking about verbal theory as well, right? By just playing out how these relationships hold.
Martin, can you talk to us a little bit about that decision? Because I think there are others who sort of, you know, whether it's that I've developed something that I've got an idea and should I pursue it in more of a formal theory way and maybe bring on someone who's got that expertise, or as in your case, go the other way where, you know, we've sort of got both options and which are we going to go with? What should scholars be thinking about in terms of maybe making the decision or at least exploring the decision to go one way or the other?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. Maybe there is no simple answer. And for us, it was a lot of sort of going back and forth. And especially in this case, because we try to integrate various concepts and mechanisms from prior work. So we struggled quite a bit over time, and it changed also through the review process, how complex the model or how broad it should be and what are the different pieces that it should incorporate. So, and of course, we do want to integrate, but at the same time, we don't want to be overly complex. So it becomes hard to understand. So that's kind of a fine line. And I think in this case, we did go back and forth, but at some point we thought that, well, we need something in order, the benefit of formal modeling and maybe simulation modeling as well, that it's, you have to be really clear about what the assumptions are and what the mechanisms are, and allows to be really precise about relationships. And I think we got to a point where we want to bring different strands of the prior mechanisms and literature together, but maybe verbal theorizing, it doesn't allow us to be as precise as we would like to be. So that's when we thought, well, bringing in the model will allow us to really be much more much more maybe clear or more precise of how we want to describe some of these relationships. But I think the decision of how big the model will be and how complex and how broad, that was evolving even more down the line. And I think we weren't entirely sure even during the review process in terms of how sort of big role the model versus the verbal part will play. And we struck a certain balance between the two. But I think that's not an easy question. But one has to kind of weigh the pros and cons of having a model. And then maybe, you know, once there's too much about the model, then one can maybe narrow the audience a little bit because, you know, verbal theorizing may have a broader appeal. But at the same time, the model is bringing in some more specific sort of clarity in it that you may not have in verbal theorizing. It's not an easy decision, I think. And for us, it was evolving over time.
Yeah, and I would just jump in. So speaking to how the paper kind of evolved, at one point we actually had verbal propositions as well, right? And those ended up getting dropped. And kind of our logic here was let's verbally theorize about some of the main effects. Right. So we have firm specificity, uncertainty, these sorts of things. Let's build that out and make propositions and let the model really start to show the interconnections and the predictions that come out when you start to integrate things. Ultimately, after some discussion through the review process, we ended up dropping those. So we did at one point have kind of a combination approach.
Can you talk to me a little bit about the length of time? It's obviously been going a long time if Joe was still a doctoral student when it started. And what sort of was happening during that length of time? Was it more that you were distracted by other projects, or how was it evolving over that period of time? Just for the purposes of someone who's, you know, working on an AMR paper and trying to understand, you don't have data, you don't have to go out and collect all this stuff. Why does it take an extended period of time to build up to a having a publishable paper? And that's prior to first submission, because you can tell from the paper that it was submitted in 2020. So we're talking sort of 5 years of development there.
Well, so I think some of it was that we were distracted by other projects, right? I mean, this was a period when, you know, both Martin and I were, I mean, Joe was kind of on the job market and got his job. Martin and I were both up for tenure. So I think we were kind of, you know, focusing on things that were more immediate. But I think a large part of it was also, you know, I think a lot of the process that we just described of sort of figuring out what's the right balance and even just figuring out the model itself, I think took a while, right? Because you have to go through multiple iterations, especially because this is not it's not like we're taking a, you know, off the shelf model where there's an established sort of paradigm and an established set of assumptions. We're pretty much building the model from scratch here. And so a lot of what ended up happening was, you know, we tried out one version, we sent a version to a conference, we presented it, we got some feedback which said, wait, you're not thinking about this problem, you're not thinking about that problem. I mean, you know, I don't even know that appropriability was necessarily even part of the original model. I think it was called bargaining power at some point. Then, you know, we got beaten up by, you know, everybody who's ever read these saying what happened to complementary assets. So we said, fine, right? And so then for a while it was complementary assets, then people beat us up for other things saying, well, there are other mechanisms of appropriability. So, you know, I think there was a sort of iterative process of saying, we'll present a version and we'll see. And I think part of the struggle with the model is kind of being able to communicate it clearly enough where people can follow what's really happening. And I think a couple of the early versions were really hard for people to sort of follow. And people had a lot of challenges and, you know, then we had to look for examples to sort of motivate some of what we were talking about. So I think there was a long process of kind of figuring that out. And every time that, and given that we were all distracted and we were all in different places, you know, we would go 6 months between or a year between one iteration and the next and say, okay, you know, let's come back in 3 months and think about this. And then, you know, we'll try something else. And then we'll try it again at a different conference with a different audience. And then we'll get some feedback. So I think it took a while. And frankly, I mean, I think, to be honest, I think we eventually, you know, got to a point where we were, I don't think we were quite done yet, but we were like, okay, no, we really, you know, we really need to submit this now because, you know, it's taken 5 years and, you know, we really need to get it into the review process. So we finally sort of forced ourselves. I think the final version got written very quickly, actually, because we just said, hey, you know, let's just take our best shot at it and at least get it under review because we can keep doing this, you know, ad infinitum.
Yeah, I think there's a few important things embedded in what you've said there, and I'll open it up to Martin and Joe to comment on any of these. Number one is that actually good ideas often need to percolate for a while, or you got to allow them to sort of take hold over a period of time, in particular where you're dealing with this level of complexity. I think if it's a simple idea that you can go out and find some empirics that are going to test it and get it out there, that's one thing. But when you're layering in this level of complexity, it's going to take iterations. It's going to need to percolate for a while. That's number one. Number two, in what I heard you say, Asim, is that a lot of people often avoid presenting conceptual papers, be they formal models or narrative conceptual papers, because you don't have the data to show, and not everyone's going to follow what you're saying in the formal model. And yet there can be such great value in that presentation and in recognizing where are people buying into what you're saying, where are you getting beaten up. And honestly, I think that's a mistake that a lot of people submitting to AMR often make, is the paper's never been presented in a public forum before. And that's why I was pleased to see that this one had been presented so many times and had obviously gone through various different iterations. And then the third thing in just what you said there was, there does come a time where you've got to sort of draw a line in the sand, because you can potentially go on forever with a conceptual paper. It's and so, you know, just forcing yourself to say, okay, we're ultimately gonna get this thing in, I think is useful advice for anybody who's been sitting on a paper for a long period of time, has presented it multiple times. So those three things: allowing percolation, presenting and getting feedback, and number three, ultimately drawing a line in the sand and getting it out there, are all important elements of ultimately being able to submit. And I think it's useful to reflect a little on those. Any comments on anything I've said there, or any anecdotes to share, Martin or Joe, about the development of this paper pertaining to those different sort of aspects?
So I just have, you know, two quick comments. So for me, I think, you know, it could be just me, but 4 or 5 years from like initial idea to have a high quality sort of submittable paper doesn't feel that long, actually. It's just, you know, of course, some projects can go very fast, but projects that require, you know, significant development, whether on the modeling side or the theory side or the empirics, they do require some time. So as you said, I mean, these ideas need to kind of mature into the right stage. And then I think the second, the other benefit I think that we got from presenting is we, if I remember correctly, the exact predictions that we're highlighting in the model now as being most interesting, that was a result of actually getting feedback. So I think it's not only whether people buy the model and its setup and its assumption mechanisms, but also what are the predictions that resonate the most with the audience? You know, which prediction should we highlight as being more interesting than others? And I think we played with that quite a bit as well. And I think it's again a result of what the audience was telling us when presenting, and then also in the review process. So kind of what we're saying now are the most novel pieces. We did not have that when we started.
I see what you're saying, because you could take these elements in multiple different directions, but it's which sort of outcomes or dependent aspects are going to appeal most to your sort of target audience for the paper.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, just to give you a, you know, I think some of the early versions of the paper had, you know, we had these three-dimensional graphs where we were sort of plotting out the value creation, value capture landscape separately. And it was very clear to us from the presentations, one, nobody understood them. And two, nobody was really that excited about them. Everybody said, okay, so, you know, what is this doing? And isn't this really dependent on, you know, and so, you know, like there would, I think, especially with the model, there's a kind of infinite, or not maybe infinite, but a very large set of potential outcomes that you can kind of plot or show different graphs, different representations that you can work with. And I think going through this process really helped to, going through the presentations really helped us to say, okay, this really resonates with people. This they find really interesting. And to be honest, some of that was not the things that, you know, I personally found the most interesting. I think there were things I found really interesting that have not even, that are in a little footnote somewhere in the paper. But, you know, that's what resonated with the audience. And we were like, okay, that's really what speaks to this literature. I think because we were trying to integrate a fairly large number of kind of ideas, I think it also exposed us to some ideas, right? So people would say, well, what about this paper? What about that paper? How does that fit with your theory? And I think that also made the model, again, some of the things that got added to the model were added because people were kind of talking about, you know, there's this line of work that you're not really engaging with yet. And we said, yeah, actually, you're right, that we really should be thinking about that more. And so, you know, that became part of the discussion and part of the paper. And that was, again, a useful process because there's so many different things that we're touching on, right? It's hard to, I think if you're in a very narrow space, then you can be a little bit more, you know, you can do the literature review yourself and you can cover it. But when you're touching on, you know, strategic human capital, mobility, entrepreneurship, startups, spin-outs, all of that, you know, it's nice to have people weigh in and say, hey, here's how I think about it. Right?
And the one thing I will say that I've observed as an associate editor at AMR is that the one thing that reviewers regularly come back on is the notion that authors have left something out. There's a concept that should be in what they're theorizing that they might have alluded to, or it only comes up in the discussion, or it's just ignored and it's in some way turned off the reviewer or offended the reviewer. And so by presenting it so many times and getting that sort of collective input, you at least partly mitigate some of that. Whereas I do think, you know, so, you know, Joe writes the paper and it's all strategic human capital, and someone else looks at it and says, oh, but there's this other piece going on around uncertainty or something else. And because you've presented it so many times, you have that there. Can you talk to me a little bit about what I found extremely valuable as someone who's not trained in formal modeling and trying to follow along with the paper were the figures and the table up front and then the table in the appendix. So can you talk to me a little bit about utilizing these figures, multiple different figures and tables, at what stage of the process did they emerge, and how did they evolve and develop over time to allow your sort of insights and perspectives to come out not only in sort of equation form, but to be visualized in a fairly powerful way? And any kind of lessons that you learned about illustrating ideas with the figures that you've got, and or providing sort of contrasting ideas in table format so that they're very clearly articulated?
Sure. Yeah. So I'm trying to think about when the tables and figures came in. I know figure one came in during the last round of revision, and that was partially because we changed the sequencing of the steps in the model.
So just describe figure one at a very high level for us, if you don't mind, Joe, and it'll come up.
Yeah. So figure one basically kind of looks through the steps in our model, right? So what has to happen in what sequence and how that ultimately results in a combination into the different types of outcomes, right? Whether it's the no offer or whether the idea gets internally commercialized or whether it goes to spin out.
So it's like a massive decision tree.
Yes,
or exactly. A fairly large decision tree. Yeah.
Exactly, right? And I think that's important because we have a lot of steps happening within the model. And initially, if I recall, correct me if I'm wrong, I think we had kind of some steps reversed in our initial submission, where initially the employee would go out, get an offer from the external market, bring it back to the employer and say, you want to match this. And some of the referees actually pointed out that in practice, many employers require that you have to kind of disclose ideas. So we kind of switched some of the sequencing. And I think that was really the impetus that said, you know what, it might make sense for us to kind of create a large decision tree so you can walk through each of the steps, right? And I think that's a nice way to kind of, again, you can read through the model setup, but you can also take a look here and very clearly get an idea of everything that's happening within the model and how it leads to the various outcomes.
Yeah, I mean, let me, so I think, as Joe said, that figure one was kind of a late addition to the paper. It was a late addition because I think it became very clear to us after a point that, you know, so we had the other figures. The other figures just show you kind of the graphs of the parameter spaces and, you know, what are the different regions in which you'll get these different outcomes, right? And so I think that's where we started with. And to be honest, I think the original model, we weren't really that concerned about the sequence of steps because we kind of said, it doesn't matter, right? It's an equilibrium in the end. So whether you go through one sequence or the other sequence, you're still going to get to the same endpoint, which is true. I think one of our big learnings from the review process, again, was that people had a really hard time with that, right? So we would talk about it as though all these things were happening simultaneously. And people would say, but that's not how this actually works, right? And so we created this decision tree. And I don't think we really thought about the steps. I think we just created this decision tree to sort of provide an easy mapping of, you know, what are the different sort of values that will give you these different outcomes? And, you know, I will say the figure looks very simple now that we've done it, but it took, you know, multiple iterations to say, wait, okay, we need all the similar outcomes to end up with the same parts of the decision tree. And that wasn't always happening. So, you know, you can draw the decision tree in many different ways. And there's only one of those iterations that actually gives you a nice, neat decision tree. You get a lot of very messy decision trees otherwise. So I think it took a while to get that done. And then we realized, okay, once we've done that, then, you know, the steps become a lot more salient. And that's why, you know, I think the reviewer pushback on that quite appropriately led us to then really think through what would be an actual sequence and what do we really think is happening. And so I think that process was quite useful. I think the other thing that happened was, you know, we again, this speaks to also to Martin's point about, you know, what is really interesting about, you know, what's really novel here. So we used to have just a simple sort of, you know, the other figures. So as I said, figure two, figure three really are sort of showing you what are the different sort of outcome parameter values, right? And they're sort of, but it used to be all spinouts were treated the same. So we would just say, you know, you'll get a spinout, right? And then as we were talking about it and as we did the decision tree, it became very clear to us that we were actually talking about different types of spinouts, right? So even though the outcome was spinout, the underlying logic for that spinout was different. You could see that from the decision tree, but it wasn't showing up in our figures. In the figures, it just said spinout. And so eventually we ended up coming up with this, and this was again in the review process, we ended up coming up with a sort of four types, different types, a typology of four different types of spinouts, which became, I think, a major part of the paper. But that wasn't really where we started. We were, you know, originally we started by saying, look, spinouts can happen the intuition was there, but it wasn't like we weren't talking about four different types of spinouts. We weren't showing that in the figures. And then I think as we kind of engaged with the review process, that became, I think, a big part of it. I think the tables were actually where we started from, because I think the tables were, as Joe mentioned, we used to have these propositions actually that went with the main kind of parameters. So saying, well, you know, the higher uncertainty is, the more you're likely to see something. And again, I think one of the things in the review process that I think was useful, again, all to other people kind of doing this kind of work, is I think once you put those propositions out there, people get very fixated on them, right? So then they kind of say, okay, well, you know, I'm going to just focus on that and not even read your model. And then when they don't read the model, they don't get a lot of the richness of what's going on. So I think to kind of almost force the reader to engage with the richness and the complexity of the interactions really required us to, you know, put in the decision tree, take out the propositions, put in some of these other things. So I think the overall point I'm trying to make is that I think it's a balance between really communicating the need for complexity, but also keeping the complexity simple enough so that a reader can kind of follow what are the sort of outcomes, right? And I think it took us multiple iterations of the review process, not to mention all the sort of iterations we did before we could kind of really capture the fact that the complexity gave us these different outcomes, but in a very clearly communicable way. And as I said, I think that also forced us to abandon some of the results and some of the tables. And, you know, we had a whole bunch of additional sort of, you know, analyses and stuff that we just dropped, saying, okay, that's going to just complicate things too much. Or I think some of them end up in footnotes or appendices or whatever. But, you know, so I think figuring out what to leave out turned out to be just as important as figuring out what to keep in.
Talking about adding to the richness, the one sort of device that you used, I guess, or thing that you did that I found, again, I'm coming in as a person who's not experienced or good at modeling or necessarily even understands all the aspects of it. But the fact that in table two, where you're providing the notation and then the description and then the values, and then you describe where, or you link that to the page number in the actual in the actual paper, I found extremely valuable. And maybe that's common practice. I haven't necessarily seen it before, but it just helped me understand at a slightly more nuanced level, as opposed to almost just glossing over. So just the fact that the page number was there and I could connect what was going on. So I thought that was useful too. But I guess, and one of the things that now that you've said that you presented this paper so many times, the figures would almost be necessary when you're presenting it, because to try and have too many equations on a screen and walk people through equations in a presentation in too much detail and with too much nuance can be incredibly tough. So capturing it in a figure seems very appropriate.
I mean, I think one other maybe non-standard innovation that I think went into this was, and I think, Greg, you referred to this a little bit as well. You know, I think we do still have, even though we took out the propositions, we do still spend quite a bit of time at the start of the paper sort of developing the main constructs and describing them using examples. So, and that's all verbal. It's not really, right? So there's a sort of long verbal section. And I think that really helped with, because I think initially, you know, I think it's hard. I think it's hard for people to immediately sort of track what do you mean by approvability and what do you mean by uncertainty, right? So I think part of the value of the model comes from the fact that we're able to, you know, capture a number of different concepts and reduce it to a single parameter. But then you have to really describe and explain to people who are not sort of necessarily used to the model, or especially because these are not sort of standard parameters that people have been using for, you know, for decades. So I think we spend a lot, and I think Joe did a lot of work to kind of go through examples, look through some of these things and say, okay, what's the best example, right? Because a lot of these things are very abstract. So it's not that easy to come up with a concrete example of what do you mean by approvability or what do you mean by uncertainty. But I think we eventually ended up kind of spending a lot of time explaining those parameters up front, which is also where I think some of the page number things came from, which was to say, okay, you know, we're not going to be able to explain this in a table. We really need someone to go back and read the text.
Yeah.
And then hopefully they can follow along. Right.
Now, I will say that setup that you're referring to, utilizing actual descriptions, reference to prior research, build it up, provide a concrete example, that should be mandatory for at least for, I think, going to a broad management journal with a modeling paper. It just opens it up to a much broader audience than, diving immediately into a bunch of different assumptions and getting into equations. So I found that extremely valuable. And as someone who's going to be, you know, stepping into a role where you're providing lots of feedback and helping authors develop, I think that is an innovation that can be carried forward and utilized going forward. So, and to anyone out there who's trying to write these kind of papers, as someone who's reading them that's not necessarily steeped in modeling expertise, that was extremely valuable.
So I just want to add to that So I agree. It's extremely, and that's what we try to do that in doing the paper, you know, grounded in the more practical things that people could relate to. But at the same time, one has to be really careful about these examples. So we did spend a lot of time thinking about them and connecting into prior work, because, you know, examples could be interpreted in very different ways of, you know, or these connections to prior empirical work could be also interpreted. So it can backfire if it's not done right. So that's, you know, I know that different modelers have different approach to this. It's maybe just keep it abstract is making it then maybe clearer for modeling crowd, but makes it harder to understand for the non-modeling crowd. But once you get to the examples, they have to be done really carefully and really, you know, done well, because otherwise it just may, you know, kind of mislead the reader into a different direction.
Can you double click on that? What does it mean to do it well? Or what's the sort of criteria that one should be using or to evaluate whether an example is resonating or making sense or fitting, if you will? Is there anything more that you can layer on there that can help people understand whether their example is hurting or helping them?
Very good question. So I'm not sure, of course, you know, guys, feel free to jump in. So for me, it's these examples or vignettes or however we can, or mini cases that one can use. They have to be unambiguous in illustrating what the mechanism or what the assumption is. Once these open up, and I think maybe the one way to do it is to also present and get feedback. Well, once they are too fuzzy or too vague, then it becomes actually doing a disservice to the model, and then it creates a disconnect and a confusion when the reader gets to the model. It's like, well, based on your example, I thought this is X, and now you're doing Y. So I think it's by doing it right, I mean, it has to be very, very clear and needs to illustrate precisely the mechanism or the assumption or what we're trying to do in the model. So it cannot be, that requires also a lot of thought and a lot of work.
And I think I totally agree with what Martin just said. And I think the thing I want to emphasize is it's about the mechanism. It's not necessarily about the, so sometimes, on the one hand, the example needs to be really unambiguous about this is what happened in that case, right? But then I think you have to be able to really draw out the underlying mechanism that you want to focus on, because what ends up happening is often, especially to keep the model parsimonious, you're going to use a parameter to cover a wide range of different things that will operate through the same mechanism, right? So you might be talking about complementary resources. I think the appropriability complementary resources point is a good one, right? So just to use an example from our own paper. Now, when we talk about appropriability, one way in which we're thinking, one thing we're thinking about is this notion of, okay, you have a bunch of complementary resources that are really critical. You have a brand or a, you know, distribution network that's really valuable that the idea really needs, right? But so that's an example, and we can come up with examples of that. But then I think you also want to be clear about the fact that what's really driving that is the fact that when the employer has this brand or distribution system or some other complementary resource, they are able to bargain for and capture a substantial amount of the value created. Once you're clear about that, then the parameter is actually just measuring how much value they're able to capture. And there could be other ways in which they might capture value, right? So they could be because they have non-disclosure agreement, non-compete agreements, and that'll also give them bargaining power, right? You don't want to create a whole other parameter for that in the model, right? So I think I agree with Martin. I think the danger in using examples is you can get too focused on the narrowness of the example, and then before you know it, you've created 20 parameters and nobody can solve your model anymore, right? So I think being able to articulate from the example, this is the mechanism that we have in mind, and that's the mechanism the parameter is capturing, rather than the, you know, we don't have a parameter for brand and a separate parameter for manufacturing and a separate parameter for distribution and a separate parameter for non-disclosure. We have one parameter, beta, but, you know, it covers all of that. So I think a lot of it comes from being able to have an unambiguous example, but then also be able to generalize the mechanism that comes out of that example.
Very useful comment. Thank you. Joe, so Asim alluded to the fact that you came up or managed to uncover or at least evolve some of those examples. Any suggestions, recommendations on how you connect examples with the parameters or with the mechanisms that are articulated in the model, or at least go out and find the examples? Is it going to prior academic research? Is it trying to find, you know, things in the newspaper? Is it, what are some of your thoughts around authors actually going out and trying to find salient, unambiguous, useful examples?
Yeah, so I think there's multiple approaches, right? So there are certain examples that you just know off the top of your head. You'll see things in the news. And this is partially why, you know, sometimes the marination process for the project actually helps. So we had this on the shelf for a couple of years, but it's been in the back of our minds marinating, right? And so you'll see something in the news, these sorts of things that'll pop up. I would echo kind of a similar thing. This goes with empirical work too, with examples, right? People can get very fixated. And you want to be very clear, again, you can tie it to the mechanism, because otherwise people can use it kind of to say, well, that scenario you highlighted, there was all sorts of other things happening, and that was the real reason why this happened. That's not a great example of what you're doing. So I think it's kind of a combination. I think usually you'll be able to tell where they fit in well, right? If you're having a tough time articulating a point, examples can be super helpful. I also think you want to be careful not to overdo it. Right? You can overdo it and it becomes more like an anecdote as opposed to kind of theory development.
Yeah. I mean, there is certainly the risk of going too far with examples or leaning too heavily on the example for theorizing as opposed to articulating the logic, the mechanism that's at work, and missing that. So I want to move towards wrapping up now, and I'd love to just get a take from all three of you of, you know, what sort of platform do you envisage this paper establishing? What could happen next? What impact might it have in terms of either future theory developments or the potential for empirical studies or for practice or policy decisions? As you think about the hope that this paper is going to have a big impact, where could or should that impact be in your minds?
Go ahead, Asim.
No, you go ahead, Martin.
So I can speak to a few things. So I think on the empirical side, it will. So I am actually doing some follow-up projects right now with Evan Starr and Ben King, based on a survey which we actually surveyed a number of companies also a couple of years back. So that project is also marinating a little bit for a while. But we actually are asking questions about ideas, you know, how they get rejected and what is driving people to leave, which ideas are internally commercialized, which ideas are then transferred to other firms, what is the recipient firm. So there is an empirical work which I think could also integrate some, and we don't know empirically these different spin-out types and which are the ones that are explaining entrepreneurship more than others. And this paper is tremendously helpful in sort of pushing my own work, and I hope the work of others as well, that will try to answer these questions. You know, what is the entrepreneurship? If we kind of open the hood, open the black box of entrepreneurship, what are these different types and which then are, you know, leading to growing firms and so on. So there's a number of, I think, empirical questions which are very important, and this paper sort of because it's built such a comprehensive framework, it helps to inform a lot of the discussion. And I think on the theory side as well, there is a potential for maybe building on some nuances here, and maybe also even drilling down on some of the specific mechanisms or building similar type of more comprehensive models that are bringing similar some of these mechanisms together to generate novel insights. So we hope to kind of affect both. And I would also like to highlight, maybe this is a more of an indirect implications, but there's a lot of discussion now in the field about entrepreneurial dynamism, and we see sort of entrepreneurship and spin-outs and some of these things declining. And I have been doing some recent work in that area as well. So, you know, there's some concern that large firms are now absorbing more innovative ideas, and we see sort of less of that knowledge flowing across firms. So of course, this is not something which we discuss directly in this paper, but I think some of the mechanisms that we talk about, such as appropriability and firm specificity and things like that, are directly relevant for those conversations that are reflecting or kind of looking at the dynamism over time of entrepreneurship. So I feel this paper you know, will play an important role in those conversations.
Yeah, very well framed and discussed. Thank you. Any other thoughts, Asim or Joe?
I guess two things. So one, I think just to build on something Martin was saying, I've already seen, the paper's been sort of in press for a while now. We've already seen a couple of papers that I think what putting together the model does is allows you to sort of take different cuts of things that maybe you hadn't thought about before. So for example, there's a now published SMJ paper by Denny Kim at Wharton that looks at, that uses the model to sort of come up with some predictions about, acquired firms and then sort of spin outs and from those things. So you're starting to see, I think, work that is able to make some of not necessarily the full connection. I don't know that we're going to see a lot of work sort of directly testing the full model, but I think taking aspects of the model. I think the other thing that one of the things I found really fascinating in doing the model from a very modeling perspective was, you know, in a lot of our game theory models, we tend to assume either full information, or even if there's information asymmetry, there is, it's asymmetry about information. And even the people who don't have the information know that they don't have the information, right? So in the kind of standard Spence type signaling models, that's always the case. So I think one of the neat things about this model is that, you know, it's a model where you have three different agents who all have beliefs. And they fully believe those beliefs and they act according to those beliefs. And I think that's actually, you know, it took a little, this is part of why it took a while, because, you know, it's a different kind of model to solve. But if you think about it, that's a situation that we see a lot, right? A lot of times people are acting on differences in beliefs. And I think the ability to sort of think about what does do differences in beliefs translate into in terms of outcomes in these kind of game theoretic models is really interesting. And I think that applies in a huge way to entrepreneurship, because there's a big literature in Austrian economics and elsewhere about, you know, subjective beliefs, etc. Lots of people have written about that, but we haven't really modeled that in a full way. But there's lots of other situations where we're starting to see people take sort of Bayesian updating more seriously. We're starting to see a lot more work that's kind of based on this idea that different people have different irreconcilable beliefs. And I think, in my mind, one of the big opportunities to push this model forward, push some of this work forward, is not necessarily outside of the sort of entrepreneurship, human capital area, is to think about modeling situations where there are these irreconcilable beliefs between actors, and how does that play out when you believe something completely different from what I believe, and we both think we're doing the optimal thing, and we both think the other person is really stupid, but you know we're going to get some outcome. Right? So I think that's really interesting.
Cool. Joe, we lost you for a minute there. You're back. Any final thoughts on next steps beyond the AMR, if you will?
So I'm sorry I missed Asim's last comments. No kind of interview is complete without a technical difficulty. My entire computer shut down. I think, you know, I would echo on the empirical side, at least, I think within the entrepreneurship space, this can maybe motivate comparing different outcomes. So Martin and I have a paper which looks at kind of, do you exploit an idea by moving to a rival versus starting a new firm, right? And so I think we're starting to see more work exploring different outcomes. So I certainly think that this could be a motivator for that. In addition, you know, again, in the spin-out literature, a lot of the things that have been discussed, appropriability, capacity, opportunity cost, these sorts of things, they're very focused in exploring one mechanism. So hopefully this can kind of serve as a motivator for other areas to maybe start thinking about integration of different kind of theoretical perspectives. And maybe a model might be a way to kind of put some structure to that. And hopefully develop kind of newer novel predictions. So kind of both on the theory and empirical side, hopefully we can spark some conversation in those areas.
Yeah. So spin out researchers, certainly entrepreneurship scholars, people trying to understand human capital aspects or strategic human capital aspects can all look at this and just more general strategy decisions, sort of make or buy and keep things inside, go outside. So it touches a lot of different pieces. And then I think the way you've tackled these different aspects of uncertainty, specificity, and appropriability, just having those as apparatus that have been utilized or described and captured so effectively in this paper can be a launch off point for many people. So thank you for sharing some of the background, some of the nuance, some of the evolution of this paper, for opening up the kimono, if you will, and just helping us see how these things evolve, sharing insights on doing presentations, on, you know, when figures were developed, how you work together as a team and different people contributed different aspects of the paper. It was incredibly interesting to hear, very revealing just to understand how something that's this sophisticated and this interesting and insightful and in some aspects complex, but in other aspects pretty simple, comes together. And I think so, well done on a great paper. When subjective judgments lead to spin-outs, employee entrepreneurship under uncertainty, firm specificity and appropriability. Look for it on the AMR website. It's still in press, but it should be out soon. Great paper and fantastic discussion. So thank you, Asim. Thank you, Martin. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you, Greg.
Thank you, Greg.